This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, May 6th. I'm Dave Bendinger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week, elders in Dillingham are being scammed for money by drug users.
So I'm sitting there still feeling wrong, but still gullible, you know. And conned me out of money three times in a row. I should have realized it, but not with health-wise the way I was, you know.
One victim shares his story, and the police tell us more about the pattern. A Port Hyden man survived an incredibly long time in the water last week after his kayak was swamped on a solo trip.
I must have passed out or something because I heard a knock on the kayak, like somebody knocking on the door, you know. And when I woke up, the seal was like 2 feet away from me, like a guardian angel watching over.
We'll break down the anatomy of a local search and rescue effort that was successful. Plus, about this time last year, every market indicator pointed to bad economic trends ahead of the salmon season, but this year things seem to have improved.
While I wouldn't get too terribly excited quite yet, I definitely think that things are going to be better than they were a year ago.
A trio of those in the know share what they know about the salmon markets. Those stories and more coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. The Towegak herring fishery for 2016 has concluded. Fish and Game closed down the seiners Saturday after they hauled in roughly 15,000 of their 20,000-ton quota. Rumors are of a $100 a ton price this year, up from last season. The fleet got off to a bad start after the fish showed up record early. Skipper Robert Hano said the weather was probably the most crippling factor.
The amount of wind consistently for days, you know, 3-4 days. And then, of course, when you're seining, you need some clear water so the pilots can see the fish, and just about when it started to clear up, it turned around and blow again. So that, in my opinion, had a huge impact on the harvest.
The quality of the deliveries was high until late in the week when the fish size dropped. Fish and Game closed the seiners to protect the younger age class herring. The gill netters stopped fishing Monday. The Bristol Bay Borough Volunteer Fire Department and a lot of other local volunteers had their hands full last Sunday battling a pair of fires. One started in the brush near the Red Salmon Cannery early Sunday afternoon and took till near 9 p.m. to fully finish fighting. Fire Department Coordinator Deborah Jones was on scene the whole time.
The wind switched a couple different times on us. We did end up getting it contained and had a lot of help from different community members coming out and assisting with the fire department. Normally we have about 20 volunteers, I would say, all together. So we had just about everybody out there and running around, and a lot of help from the community. It was really great to see everybody come together and help out when we needed some assistance.
The fire may have been caused by embers from people burning trash nearby. Late that same night, the department was back out for a steam bath fire, which was lost, but nearby property was saved. On Monday, a large crane on an Alaska Marine Lines barge dropped into the water off Ekuk Dock, temporarily stopping a frenzy of preseason activity at that beach. AML did not respond to media inquiries, but one witness nearby reported what happened. Rick Dahlman of Dillingham was there working on a building project.
So, of course, we had a bunch of stuff in that barge that we were waiting to get offloaded to. You know, I think it was just a mechanical failure the way it looked, because the crane operator wasn't even in it. It was kind of parked for lunch or something. And, you know, it looked like the boom just all of a sudden started coming down and then just, you know, toppled over the side, and that was it.
AML apparently sent for a crane from Naknek to come help in the retrieval efforts. Unloading at Ekuk was temporarily delayed by the accident. In Bethel, the AC Quick Stop opened the first liquor store in that city in 40 years to eager customers on Tuesday.
I bought one bottle of Jameson, one bottle of Crown Royal, and 2 6-packs of Corona, and I'm going to go enjoy them right now.
Sales topped $1,300 in the first hour. John McIntyre was one of the first day's more than 500 customers and said despite any impacts of lifting the local ban on alcohol sales, he thinks this says a lot about Bethel.
I do think it's time we grew up. I mean, there's legal booze sales in Dillingham, McGrath, Nome, Kotzebue. If it doesn't work here, it's us, not the booze.
In other news this week, federal managers yet again have changed the rules to try and allow hunters to help cull back the oversized caribou herd on the Nooshigak Peninsula. Hunting was reopened till May 10th. Towegak Refuge biologist Andy Aderman says the hunt was closed after a two-week extension, and this may be the first time it's ever been reopened this way.
I fully expected somebody would request that. I didn't pursue it myself. You know, April 15th is the longest we've ever hunted down there for caribou. Biologically, it's justified to hunt, but it is approaching calving season here mid-month, so that's the reason it closes on May 10th.
Only 60 to 70 caribou were taken since last summer. A better harvest number to help control the herd would have been 600, according to Aderman. On the other side of the bay, fish and wildlife biologists have confirmed a new haul-out spot for Pacific walrus near Cape Gregg. Residents and pilots transiting along the coast north of Ugashik had been reporting that there were more walrus there than they'd ever seen before. Refuge manager Susan Alexander says she and her staff checked it out last month.
We have in our flights up and down the peninsula since early April seen concentrations of walrus hauled out at Cape Gregg, which as far as we know is a new haul-out location for them. They seem to be coming and going. We've seen as many as 2,000 and as few as zero.
Cape Gregg is not on refuge lands, but the Fish and Wildlife Service has jurisdiction to protect marine mammals. They say they'll be notifying pilots and vessels about appropriate distances to keep. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. Listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond. This time last year, anyone you talked to about the salmon markets was gloomy. None of the indicators were good, and sure enough, when a base price of 50 cents was paid out at the end of the monster Bristol Bay harvest, there was disappointment, but not necessarily complete surprise. This year, however, there seems to be a little better picture emerging. For more on this, I asked the opinions of Norm Van Vactor, Andy Wink, and Gabe Dunham. Van Vactor is the president and CEO of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, which is hosting its annual Business of Fish workshops this weekend. I caught up with him outside the meeting this morning.
I think just in general, things are much more positive. Now, there's degrees of optimism, right? So I'm cautionary, I guess, in my optimism, but there's definitely, you know, a lot of things that are significantly different than last year. We've seen a significant change in the exchange rate. The dollar has weakened, and so this is going to allow folks both in Asia and Europe to hopefully, you know, with the same equivalent currency in their pockets, buy more of our product. The Ukrainian situation, while not significantly stronger than a year ago, the conflict there seems to be on hold, and there are small inroads being made there. The algae bloom, unfortunately for those folks in South America, is benefiting us in terms of the volume, recent volume of farm fish that's being imported in the U.S. from South America. So there are those factors which last year were just the opposite. That were going against us. Like I said, they kind of contributed last year to what I have described as the perfect storm of negatives. Mm-hmm. So while I wouldn't get too terribly excited quite yet, I definitely think that things are going to be better than they were a year ago.
Andy Wink is a senior seafood analyst with the McDowell Group, which prepares sockeye market analyses commissioned by the BBRSDA each year. Some of his work for ASME and the RSDA will be published in the weeks ahead. I asked him this week for a preview of some of that, specifically about the inventory of frozen and canned salmon.
In a nutshell, we still have more inventory of canned pinks, especially, and reds, than we'd probably like. We've seen canned sales volumes of canned reds pick up. Pinks are still difficult. So, we'll be keeping a close eye on that. The sales volume of canned salmon tends to adjust much more slowly than, say, the frozen market. But in the frozen market, we've seen very good sort of velocity through the supply chain. You know, if we were talking this time last year, we would have been talking about all the frozen H&G left in inventory after the 2014 season. But this year things moved a lot smoother. Product went out, a little bit faster, and so. But I think we're sitting in pretty good shape. ASME also did a lot of in-store demonstrations and promotions in the domestic market, and the one that just is wrapping up ran through Lent, and I think that helped suck up some of the you know, whatever inventory was left. But in general, frozen stuff went a lot faster than last year, where we had some issues there last year with frozen inventory. And we're still dealing with canned, but I think sales are starting to trend up at least, so that's encouraging.
Okay, again, Andy Wink there talking about current inventory. I also asked him about the competing supply he expects to see this year.
I think the biggest impact we'll see is from the algae crisis in Chile. The people who watch the farm salmon industry very closely in terms of how much production is coming out are predicting a 6-7% decline for 2016 in farmed Atlantic production. And that's very significant because, you know, farmed Atlantic production has probably averaged about plus 5% over the last 10 years or so. So anything that's a decline really feels much deeper than that. Chilean coho were also affected by that. Their production is probably going to be down 20-30% this year. And that has big ramifications for Alaska sockeye because Alaska sockeye compete with Chilean coho in Japan. The other thing, too, is in terms of other wild competing supplies, you know, some of the fisheries might be closed in the Pacific Northwest. It's a down sockeye year for Canada. They tend to have a pop in the Fraser River once every 4 years or so. And the kind of wild card is Russia. Russia and Japan have had a offshore drift net fishery that has been opened by treaty for many years. And that fishery tends to target sockeye kind of at sea through using drift nets. But obviously that blocks a lot of other fish from coming into the Sea of Okhotsk as well. The last time that they banned that fishery was in 2009, and Russia, I think, had its largest pink salmon year ever in that year. So, you know, there's a chance we could see more pinks especially, and perhaps chum and coho and other species caught in Russia. But I think that having that fishery banned will probably take at least high-quality sockeye out of the supply in Japan. So, you know, all in all, I think pretty supportive data points as we head into the 2016 season surrounding competing supply.
Again, Andy Wink from the McDowell Group there. He'll be publishing more information in the weeks ahead. But for more on this subject, I'm glad to be joined again by Gabe Dunham, the Marine Advisory Program Agent in Bristol Bay, who watches all of these things as well. Gabe, glad to have you in to offer your perspective.
Thanks for having me, Dave. Good to be here.
What are some of the market factors that you keep an eye on, especially about this time of the year? We're 6 weeks away from fishing.
The major things that I like to look at are anything that I think is going to affect world salmon market supply. The next thing I look at are currency changes. A couple of the other things I also look for when looking at market factors are just general economic trade and political issues, either of which could affect supply or demand in the end.
Because last year we were talking about trade embargoes with Russia, and that was playing in. Let's break down some of those. Tell me what you know about salmon supply on the world market.
It's interesting to throw a few facts and figures out there first. First of all, the Bristol Bay salmon supply constitutes about 5% of the world supply, which stands somewhere on the order of 1.3 billion pounds of salmon. So
salmon, not just sockeye.
Correct. That's all salmon.
What is happening in the world market?
Well, yeah, you touched on it already. The Chilean die-off has been a big deal this year in the farm salmon market for sure. They lost, I think, on the order of 23 million fish to the harmful algal bloom problem that they've been struggling with. In addition, we've got sea lice problems in Norway as well affecting their output.
Okay, so two very robust sources of farm salmon, Chile and Norway, are having issues.
Absolutely.
23 million die-off is half the size of last year's run for us. That's a lot of fish.
That is a whole bunch of fish.
All right. So these would indicate better factors for our Bristol Bay market to a degree. Tell me how the currency and the value it trades at affects our market and what trends are we seeing right now?
So if we go back to about 2014, we can see some of the changes in the exchange rates between the U.S. dollar and the euro and the U.S. dollar and the yen. Two of our major markets for that we sell our sockeye to. In 2014, or from 2014, I should say, it looks like the dollar strengthened in comparison to the euro, and that's carried up to about the fall of 2015, although it's starting to creep down a little bit. So that could be working in our favor here. Kind of a similar story for the yen. Around 2014, we're seeing about somewhere in the order of 100 yen to the dollar. It's kind of crept up to perhaps 125 yen to the dollar, but now kind of going back down again to about 115, 118. So both of those exchange rates are, like I said, primary markets for our fish.
And we want, generally speaking, we want a weaker dollar.
Correct. If we want to make it attractive for other people to buy our fish, we want a weaker dollar, and that really hasn't been the case. It would seem much of 2015, but we can see in the recent months, in the first part of, or at least the first quarter of 2016, we see our dollar is not being quite so robust compared to those other currencies, and that could help kick up our price a little bit around here.
Okay, something else that comes into play. Now, it's not exactly a great bellwether, I don't think, for looking at the market as a whole, but you keep a careful eye on the value of permit prices for the bay, and they have ticked back up recently, but that's after they dropped quite a bit. Where are we at now?
If you take the average of most of the trading firms, we're at about 120 or 125,000. And like you said, they've ticked up a little bit back from the low that we saw in the fall of 2015 and last winter.
Which was, what were they?
Just below 100, I believe.
Okay. I have heard from BBDC and others that the trend is the permit prices tend to drop a bit in the fall and the winter, and right about now they do tend to come back up right before the season.
Sure, yeah, I've heard that too. And you know, I think generally permit prices are, in this case, indicating that people are pretty confident, a little bit more confident perhaps than last year about going into the season.
Let's see, general outlook on your end?
Going into last year, we had several factors that really stacked up against us to sort of push the price down. This year, we're kind of looking better in a few of those areas. You know, we've got perhaps a slightly less robust U.S. dollar against some of our major currencies that we're worried about or that we're trading with, I should say. But also, we're looking at what appears to be not a significant amount of growth in the farm salmon industry. So we've got those two factors that I think are going to help encourage people's confidence this year, and we've kind of seen that in the permit prices.
Your best guess on a going home price this year?
No way. Not a gambling man on that one, Dave.
Gabe Dunham, Marine Advisory Program Agent for Bristol Bay. Always good to have you on this program.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Three outlooks there with similar cautious optimism that this year will be better than last. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment. Let's stick with salmon for a moment. Each summer, millions of them return here to Bristol Bay, swim on to their natal streams, spawn, and die. Exactly what compels them to return to the right spot each year is unknown, but scientists think that some hatchery-raised steelhead in Oregon may hold a clue. KDLG's Molly Dishner takes a look.
Are salmon social creatures? That's the question a pair of researchers are trying to figure out.
50-some million fish last season migrated into Bristol Bay in the course of just a couple of weeks, and that's sort of a classic thing, is that the fish all come at the same time. And sort of curious to think, is there a potential social role in that? They all come as a major wave, and is it because that they are in these groups and that they are using social dynamics to help aid their migrations?
That was UAF Fisheries Professor Peter Wesley. By digging fake streams at an Oregon lab, he and colleague Andrew Birdall are trying to figure out why salmon choose the streams they do.
So we actually tested this idea by giving steelhead that had migrated home to a hatchery. We brought them to the Oregon Hatchery Research Center and put them in these artificial streams and gave them a choice between water that smelled more like home, so it had some of the water from their home hatchery, or all of the foreign water that came from the stream where the Hatchery Research Center was based. And so one of the things that we showed with this steelhead system, that indeed fish that are moving upstream and moving around are very social. They don't move independently. They're in groups moving around.
Wesley says there are plenty of details still to work out, and so far, they just have a tantalizing teaser of some possible results. He and Birdall have been interested in this social side of fish behavior for some time, and their collaboration started with a paper that just looked at existing literature and data and came up with the big hypothesis.
Poses this idea of a collective social role of salmon as they're migrating home, such that salmon or other migratory fish can school together, and by being in groups, they can share information and pool their abilities to navigate and orient, and by doing so, the group is much more likely to get home than if the group was smaller or if the individual is traveling by itself, where the onus of getting to the right spot would all be on the individual.
Wesley says he thinks smell or pheromones play a role in salmon communication, but that's part of what he'd like to test. For now, the studies look at steelhead, mostly for simplicity. Wesley says they're a good proxy for salmon because they're pretty similar fish in terms of life history and making a predictable return to their birthplace.
They are a good model for these migratory seagoing fish that come back home. They have subtle differences in life history, but in terms of the social aspects and the migration and orientation, I think they're a good model.
Not everything about the study is a direct translation to the natural world, and there are plenty of changes and questions to address in the future. Wesley says they hope to repeat the experiment with a stronger scent of the home streams, and they might change the timing of the study to tie in more closely to when steelhead are actually on the move. Somewhere on the list, he says he'd also like to look at how wild fish fare.
The challenge is always trying to scale from what you're doing at sort of an experimental level up into the complexity of nature and trying to assess, you know, what you've done at this small controlled scale. Does it relate to nature as a whole? It's always a challenge.
But it's a challenge Wesley says he's excited to keep looking at. In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
Continuing this week's show, a rather disturbing trend has emerged, and it's not just here in Dillingham, but DPD Police Chief Dan Pasquarello dropped by to talk about it this week.
What we've been noticing over the past couple months, starting in March and in April, is elderly residents becoming victims of theft perpetrated by young people.
What type of theft, and what's the relationship you see between the young people and these victims?
Different types of theft are taking an elder's ATM card and removing money from it without their permission, taking checks from their grandmother or other elderly relatives, forging them, taking money out of their bank account, or just flat out scamming an elderly person.
How so?
We've charged two individuals with theft where they approached an elder man, represented themselves as from a fuel company, and had the elders write them checks.
We know that the idea of scamming elderly people is not new. In fact, there was even an article published this week in the Alaska Dispatch talking about the brain begins to become more susceptible to these things. But still, it's disappointing. And in talking with you here, you suggest that this is related to drugs, basically.
We've noticed that there's been a pattern recently, and it's pretty much the same crowd of people, part of what we call the milieu, that are taking money from elderly people, most likely to purchase controlled substances.
Can you remind us why these drug habits become so costly? What's an amount of, say, heroin that a person might use in a day, and what does that cost?
As I mentioned, there's always been thefts here. Years ago, when I first started, people stole money to buy alcohol. The thief could get their daily dose of alcohol for, say, $20. Okay, if you're, say, dependent upon heroin, if you're a heroin addict, it's going to cost you at least $100 a day to get your daily dose of heroin.
DPD Chief Dan Pasquarello there. He said there are three separate cases being investigated at the moment. Charges have been filed against two of the women involved in one of the cases. There were probably three young adults who convinced a local man they were his new fuel distributor and showed up at the door asking for payment. It happened on three occasions and cost the elderly fellow about $1,000. The scam victim's name is Pat Durbin, a longtime Dillingham resident. Many of you remember as the city's harbor master for a long time. Durbin is 83 and keeps a nice house over on Nurka Loop. It's a pleasure to meet him for the first time Wednesday night, but I wish the circumstances had been other than him sharing how he'd been scammed.
I'll give you the basics before the other.
Okay.
Out in my yard, I had a little stump like this, and I went, this is about 3 years ago, and I went back and got my little riding lawnmower stuck on. I, like a fool, I tried to lift it up from the back. And I not only heard it, but I felt everything pop. And so about 3 years of suffering with it, I finally decided to go into Anchorage. And I went, spent 3 months in there, and the inside was pulled loose, you know, from lips and that. So I'm still on medication when I came home, you know, on that there. And not thinking straight, and I got conned into giving my money out, you know? And trouble of it is, I'm sitting there wondering about it, but yet I still went along with it, you know? It was supposed to be for fuel, and I specifically asked, I said, I got the Delta Western, had them for years. Well, they're going out of business. You know, they specifically said they was going out. We're taking over, you know. Direct statement, you know. Well, I said, how come they never sent me a notice? You know, little things like that I remember saying, you know. So I questioned it, you know. And somehow in the conversation, they got me talked into it, you know. They're going out of business. Well, that's always possible. You know, they changed hands before, you know, and that there. And so I'm sitting there still feeling wrong, but still gullible, you know. And I sat there and conned me out of money three times in a row. I should have realized it, but not with health-wise the way I was, you know. And only afterwards did I realize it.
At that point, Durbin says he contacted his fuel company, his bank, and the police department. The police were not surprised to hear about it, and it didn't take them long to build a case. Durbin says he thinks he fell for the same type of approach from the same people three times, twice writing checks for over $300 and once giving out cash.
Yeah. Two of them was on the same conversation, one after the other. That should have been a send-off to me right away, you know, but the way I was thinking at the time, you know.
He also says at one point he came home and the same people were standing at his fuel tank. He thinks he may have caught them in the act of stealing fuel or the fuel filter. It was hard to tell what was happening.
I think I did, you know, but you're never for sure about these con games, you know.
Right.
They can catch me up. My very gullible time, you know. I'm only 83, you know. But what can they give me if I beat them up? 20 years? So that gives me 103. With room and board? That's the way I'd look at things now, you know. In other words, I just don't give a... I'm going to do what I'm going to do when things happen, you know, if I can catch it with my mind. And I'm pretty good most of the time, but...
Something particularly upsetting about seeing elders get scammed out of their money, perhaps because when they realize what's happened, sometimes these people blame themselves. Durbin says he knows those who got the better of him used the money for drugs, and he's disappointed by that. and yet he still seems hard on himself.
Well, but I appreciate you sharing. It's a lesson in my life, you know.
Maybe by sharing it, some other people will be able to avoid it. Same thing
happened. Be able to avoid it, and then the people that have been and don't want to speak about it, it's about time to come out and speak about it, you know.
Again, that was 83-year-old Pat Durbin speaking this week. Police believe that Johnny Filipek, Sydney Schlosser, and Pearl Lyle were the perpetrators of this scam. Charges have been filed against Schlosser and Lyle, but so far the police could not pin it on Filipek, who was already in custody on other charges. Police say they're investigating two other elder scam cases from last month and believe there are more that will soon be reported. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment. Finally, this week, we heard about a marine adventure gone wrong outside of Port Hyden that happened last Thursday. It didn't make our news sooner, partially because the search and rescue mission was so quick and effective. KDLG's Hannah Colton breaks down the story.
Port Hyden Bay is partly sheltered from the ocean by a narrow strip of land that stretches north across the mouth. At the end of it is Stroganoff Point, about 5 miles across the water from the village. That's where 36-year-old Andrew Lind was headed on a Thursday afternoon.
Well, it is a beautiful, flat, calm day, and I wanted to go out kayaking out on the ocean, look at the wildlife.
Lind describes himself as a normal village guy. Originally from the Chignecks, he does subsistence, and he's a crew leader for the hazmat cleanup project at Port Hyden's old military site. Lind set out just after 1 p.m. and paddled to Stroganoff Point in his 8.5-foot plastic kayak. He took in the sights and then turned around.
Halfway back, I texted my wife and told her I'm on my way back.
Lind sent that text at 3:37 p.m.
And by that time, the wind and the waves started picking up, and I got caught up in the main channel, and a white cap tipped me over.
Lind got himself out of the kayak and started trying to put it upright. But every time he tried to flip it, it would just scoop up more water and get more swamped.
So I couldn't do that, and then I just leaped the kayak upside down in order to the air pocket in the bow.
He wasn't wearing any flotation device, but he was able to keep his head out of the water by hanging onto the boat. Lind says pretty soon his arms just cramped around the kayak, holding him in place. Based on the time in the text message, Lind and his friends and family figure he was in the water somewhere between 1.5 and 3 hours. According to NOAA, the average water temperature there at this time of year is just under 40 degrees.
It felt like I was in there forever, like nobody was going to come.
Somebody did come, even before the rescue crew, but it wasn't a human someone.
At one point, there was a seal. I must have passed out or something because I heard a knock on the kayak, like somebody knocking on the door, you know? And then when I woke up, the seal was like 2 feet away from me, like a guardian angel watching over, keeping me awake.
Back in Port Hyden, Lynn's wife, Miranda, realized he was overdue. Around 5:30, she started calling people to help. James Christensen is Lynn's brother-in-law and a pilot who owns the only private plane in the village.
So we took off and we went out to check the islands across the bay and couldn't find them. So we started searching between the bayside and the mainland. My daughter happened to see some movement in the water.
It was just 15 minutes after they took off that Christensen's daughter spotted Lind about 2 miles offshore. They began circling low and radioed to people in the village who were launching two skiffs. Bruce Bishop, a coworker of Lind's, drove one of the boats.
Ironically, we got the first skiff got almost to him. He was just in front of me, got almost to him, and ran out of gas. Somebody had taken the gas out of his skiff.
Luckily, Bishop's skiff did have a full tank, and he and two other men made it to Lind just after 7 p.m.
Oh, my God, he was just a horrible blue color. Boy, he was just not in good shape at all. And Andrew's a big boy. Andrew's probably, 260 or better, and it was everything that the three of us could do to drag him over the side of the boat.
The boat crew says Lind was conscious and coherent. Lind doesn't remember anything from when he was pulled from the water until he came to at the clinic. His core temperature had dropped to 92 degrees by the time health aides started warming him up with heated blankets. This is not your typical search and rescue story. The entire operation happened in less than 2 hours with no outside help from troopers or Coast Guard. And of course, there was plenty of luck involved. If Lind hadn't had cell service, if Jimmy Christensen had been flying elsewhere that day, so many things could have ruined this happy ending. But one thing that didn't seem like luck is the way people in Port Hyden knew how to spring into action. Bruce Bishop, the skiff driver, says that's not an accident. He and some of the other rescuers all work at the hazardous waste cleanup site, so they all have up-to-date first aid, CPR, and other training. But it's not just the training.
We work together every day, so there's no, we have good communication skills between us, and probably what made this all work, you know.
Andrew Lind says what kept him kicking was faith and his family.
There's lots of praying to God, talking to my family and my kids and my wife, who would take care of them if something did happen. I think that's what pushed me to hold on.
He doesn't know what to make of the seal. Later, rescuers would find that seal stayed near the kayak until well after Andrew was safely out of the water. For KDLG, I'm Hannah Colton.
And that's it for this week's show. My thanks to Hannah Colton and Molly Dishner for their help. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Band Beyond at kdlg.org. I'm Dave Benninger. Happy Mother's Day to all. Hopefully many of us are feeling a little bit warmer about the occasion than this guy.
Happy Mother's Day to the mothers on Sunday. And happy Mother's Day to my wife, even though I hate her guts.
From Open Line earlier today. It could be its own brand of Hallmark cards, perhaps. We'll see you next week.